up in here.
Hope you forgive me if I don't sit in the impressive lotus position. You know, I get cramps. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshura Nimittam Yeda Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nama. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatidesha Tari. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Hello. Nice to see you all. I don't know everybody. I see some old faces. I didn't mean that. I see some old friends. People I've known for, like, I saw Ragatmika here. We've known each other for 40 some odd, which is interesting because she's only 45. So we were very, very young. There's Vishaka and Yarubara. It's kind of like Vishakubara at this was like Brangelina. You know, you just. Who else is? Advaita Acharya is here from Philadelphia. Very bold. And your son who's grown up so nicely. My name is Yogeshwar Das. My students call me Sir. You don't have to do that. I joined the temple in London in 1969. And almost from the beginning, my work was in publishing. So I kind of gravitate toward writing and teaching. By the way, this is what is known in the trade as shameless product placement. It's the book is not out yet, but this is a reading copy. It'll look like that. Be out in May. The purpose of this biography of Srila Prabhupada was that it was a little frustrating for me. I do a lot of teaching in universities and in yoga studios, and I didn't have a simple one-volume approachable biography that would tell Srila Prabhupada's life and introduce people to the basics of his teachings. So I thought, maybe I should do that. And there was encouragement from a lot of senior devotees, which I'm very grateful for. The North American temple presidents have asked me to talk about the book in January at their meeting in Houston, but they asked me to talk about it. How would I present Prabhupada in a university or yoga studio environment? So I put together something, and you're the test run tonight. This is a dress rehearsal. So I'm looking for feedback. You'll have to tell me when the formal part of this is done, whether you like it or not. There are things that you think should be changed. I was a little uncertain because it's not the usual kind of class about Srila Prabhupada, and I talked it over with my wonderful daughter-in-law, Sundari. I came here actually to see her and my granddaughter, Radhika. Oh, and my son, Namamrita. And she actually offered me some encouraging words. She said, what do you care? You're leaving Wednesday. So I thought that was the right answer. So I'm just going to go for it. Okay, so I wanted a way, how can people get into this story? And as someone who's taught about myths and legends and something called the monomyth or the hero journey, I thought there might be a way to put these two things together. So bear with me. You know, it may not be the usual way of going about this. But I think maybe you'll glean something from it. The monomyth or hero journey is, this will go for maybe a half hour, then we'll open this up to Q&A right away, is a story arc. It's a template. It's a structure, a narrative structure that traces the evolution of a person who leaves a dark world. Does this work here? If I turn it on, maybe it'll work. Okay. Someone who leaves a dark place and the Maya world, if you will, and sets out on an adventure. And along the way, this hero individual confronts crises and obstacles and overcomes those obstacles and achieves a great victory, and then has the option of bringing into the world the light that has been attained through this journey. The concept was introduced in the late 1940s by mythologist Joseph Campbell, who you see here on television with Bill Moyers on the left, in Campbell's book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Now, what happened was that Joe Campbell, who passed away in the 80s, one of the important mythologists of the 20th century, traveled the world, and he discovered that this basic narrative pattern exists in all myths and legends and in the lives of great historic personalities. He admitted it's not a rigid template, this journey, which is basically the departure, initiation, and return. You can describe a hero journey in those three basic steps. There's a leaving, there is a initiation into the quest for the grail or the boon or the prize, the treasure, and then a return with that treasure into the world. He admitted it varies from culture to culture, but still there's no denying, you can see it can get very complicated here in this image, there's no denying that there are commonalities in the great stories of history that describe how women and men arrive at groundbreaking achievements. So it can get even more complex than this, by the way, but the basics follow this general outline. There's the ordinary world, right? What we might call the Maya world, or the matrix, or the conditioned life, call it what you will, the conditioned world and life that we're born into. Then there's what's called the call to adventure, often triggered by meeting a mentor, which was certainly true in Srila Prabhupada's case. There's a road of trials. If someone agrees, either by circumstance or voluntarily, to embark on this trial, on this call to adventure, he confronts trials along the way. The journey to self-realization, to understanding who we are as eternal beings, is not an easy one. I think Prabhupada really tricked us in the beginning when he said, just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. I think if we had known how many trials we might be encountering, we might have prepared ourselves in a different way. At a certain point along this journey, the hero crosses the threshold. And at that point, there's no turning back. This is the point of no return. There is an ordeal, which sometimes might be called a baptism by fire, which in myths might be confronting a dragon or something that's life-threatening. And if you're able to survive that challenge, then you move on to achieving the boon, whether it's a treasure that's hidden or the grail, or there are many kinds of boons. And then you return. The hero returns to the mortal world, the ordinary world, with the option of sharing that light or that knowledge or that treasure with the rest of society. Not all heroes do so. Some people might come to Krishna consciousness and say, oh, I get it now. I'm an eternal spirit soul. Go back into society? Are you crazy? I'm out of here. I'm going to India. You're not going to see me again. And for some people, that's the right thing to do. Becoming a world preacher is not for everybody. Some people wisely choose to defer that kind of a mission in order to cultivate their spiritual life more clearly. If you've seen, if you apply this template of the hero journey to any great story, you'll see that more or less it fits. If you've seen any of these films, and of course I know we don't go to movies, but if you've seen any, Hollywood loves the monomyth. Hollywood absolutely loves the hero journey. There was a Disney screenwriter named Christopher Vogler who wrote a book called The Writer's Journey in 1985. It's basically the Bible for screenwriters, and it follows this template of the hero journey. So we see this pattern repeated across time, across cultures, across religions, and most prominently in the life of Lord Jesus. Now, if you study the life of Jesus, not to compare the life of Jesus with a Hollywood film, but the life of Jesus conforms more or less to this structure, as does the life of the Buddha and Prophet Muhammad, and all go through a type of monomythic journey to bring knowledge and light and God's mission into the world. There may be some of you who are fans of Lord of the Rings. It's there in Tolkien as well. It's there in many Bible stories. Jason and the Golden Fleece. And Jason's search for that golden fleece, and the trials of Odysseus, who you see in the bottom right there, the great epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's there in Ahab's quest for the great whale in the story of Moby Dick. It's there in the rise of Joan of Arc, from obscure peasant girl in medieval France to a military leader who sought France's victory in its long-running war with England. In the novel Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte brings readers into the emotions and experiences of the title character, which trace her growth to adulthood and the gradual unfolding of Jane's moral and spiritual sensibility. It's also a kind of hero journey. It's embedded in the freedom marches of the 1960s, the way we come to the kind of rights and privileges that we also enjoy exercising our freedom of religion in the United States. These rights and privileges did not come easily. There were hero journeys. There were trials that were needed to come to this point. For I have a dream, as Martin Luther King, that famous speech, and what is a monomyth after all if not the following of a dream? And we tend to impose these hero-like expectations on our political leaders. Here is Obama, Juan Kenobi, with his healthcare lifesaver. And as you know, I study this stuff and teach it at the university level. I was saying, does it apply in the Vedic texts? And I went through the stories, and it's there. This same, instead of monomyth, if that word makes you uncomfortable, because we do not have any superstructure that supersedes Krishna consciousness. So I'm thinking, is there another way to describe this? And I think the simple way to describe it is yajna, sacrifice. The giving up of something inferior for the purpose of something superior, often at great cost. So I think you can think of it in that way. And if you read the stories of Prahlad and Dhruva, if you read the stories of Narada, Jad Bharat, if you read, of course, in the Mahabharata, the trials of the Pandavas, very much conform to this hero journey. It's there also in the lives of our acharyas, the sacrifices of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his son Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And for us, becoming devotees is perhaps the greatest monomythic journey of all. And we've gone through these. If you think about your life in Krishna consciousness, there's been a call to adventure. There's been a meeting with the mentor, the spiritual masters. There's been a road of trials. You've all gone through ordeals of different kinds. We've all known these different stages. There's a very famous quote by Joseph Campbell, who wrote the book about the monomyth, where he says, we must let go of the life we have planned so as to accept the one that is waiting for us. That's the journey that we're all on. And in the Gita, I went through the Bhagavad Gita and said, does this journey appear anywhere in the Gita? And there are verses in the Gita. If you look at, sacrifice must be performed, that second chapter, giving up lower taste for higher taste, along this path, there is great progress, success for the rigid practitioner, my devotee will never perish, which suggests that we may be in a situation where we might perish. So there's always some kind of sacrifice that has to be made in the progress toward full self-awareness and Krishna consciousness. And of course, the ultimate command of Krishna to stand and fight, which is really what it's all about. It's overcoming the fears and hesitations and the shadows that hold us back from becoming all that we can possibly be in this lifetime. And of course, the monomyth is dramatically evident in what is arguably the single most pervasive myth of contemporary world culture, namely Star Wars. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not Star Wars. In Ramayana. Oh, wait a minute. Now, why am I getting these two things confused? Well, maybe it's because they're identical. Check this out. In both stories, there is a dark lord who wants to take over the universe. There is a beautiful princess whom the dark lord kidnaps, and the dark lord holds the princess captive until a young hero sets out to find the princess and rescue her. There is a wise teacher who instructs the prince how to use mystic weaponry that will help him to rescue the princess. There is a monkey-like creature who helps the prince rescue the princess. There's also a feisty older brother, buddy-type person who helps the prince rescue the princess. The heroes wage a great battle against the Dark Lord and his forces of evil, and there are these giant things that they have to fight. And they win the battle with the help of an army of monkey and bear-like creatures. Then there's a grand coronation where the prince and princess return to their capital, and harmony is restored to the universe. Okay, now devotees would say this is the story of Ramayana. More or less everybody else would say it's Star Wars. The point being that the hero journey model applies pretty well. It applies pretty well, even within our Vedic tradition. And it's not unusual. In the 1970s, George Lucas, the creator of Star Wars, invited Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, to live at Lucas Ranch during the writing of the Star Wars scripts. And Campbell explained to Lucas at that time the story of the Ramayana. And Lucas later admitted that he was, quote, influenced by Eastern myths, end quote, while writing the scripts for Star Wars. So those scripts could very well be analyzed as a screen adaptation of the Ramayana. Well, let's take a look at Srila Prabhupada's hero journey. Right. We're in early 1900s Calcutta, the capital city of British colonial India, what we might call the ordinary world. There are some European sympathizers to the Hindu culture, but the majority of British in India see the natives as heathens who must come up to Christianity if they are ever to be saved from their uncivilized ways. And there's a growing hostility among the indigenous peoples, the native peoples of India, toward the British, who look down on Hindus with disdain. What was the main objection of the Europeans to Hindu culture? Any ideas? Yep, absolutely. The single greatest objection that the British had was what they called idol worship. Here's the quote from one missionary from the late 1800s. "Whatever plausible argument may be advanced for image worship, we believe if history teaches anything, it teaches that such worship materializes and debases the human mind, gives most unworthy views of God, and in the case of the vast majority leads to a fetishism which in principle is identical with that of the most barbarous tribes. Till India rises above this idolatry, she will never have her proper place in the world." Which deity do you think the British most objected to? Radha Krishna. In the words of British Supreme Court Judge Sir Joseph Arnold, quote, "It is Krishna, the darling of 16,000 gopis, Krishna, the love hero, who tinges the whole system with the strain of carnal sensualism or strange transcendental lewdness." Here's a very powerful and influential Christian missionary from the time, Alexander Duff. "Of all the systems of false religion ever fabricated by the perverse ingenuity of fallen man, Hinduism is surely the most stupendous." This was a typical attitude among many of the colonists and missionaries at the time. True bhakti culture, true devotional culture, a real understanding of Radha Krishna worship as God in female and male form, the soul's ecstatic love for personal divinity, this was all but lost after Mahaprabhu disappeared in 1533. And the British, in a sense, were reacting to a perverted version of Vaishnava culture, Radha Krishna worship. What they were responding to was the culture of the Sahajas and the ganja smokers, and the not the high philosophy of the Goswamis, but everything that had been turned into material debauchery in the name of Radha Krishna worship. So nothing was really understood about it. Religious leaders were mostly trained in Advaita Vedanta and the impersonalist understanding, and they chose not to defend personalist ideology. Here you have Swami Vivekananda. "Images, crosses, and crescents are simply so many symbols to hang spiritual ideas on. Idolatry in India does not mean anything horrible. It is the attempt of undeveloped minds to grasp higher spiritual truths." This is what's called condemning with faint praise. So they chose not to defend the religious culture. Their response, their interest, was to get rid of everything that was offensive to the Europeans. Anything that was objectionable, let's show that that's some vestige of ancient Indian culture. That's a part of our undeveloped civilization. Here we have the first vice president of India, Dr. Radhakrishnan. It is not the personal Krishna to whom we have to give ourselves up utterly, but the unborn, beginningless, eternal, who speaks through Krishna. The idea being, you Westerners, if you look closely at Indian culture, you will find that we're not actually idolatrous at all. We worship the same God that you worship, just in a different form. Right? And how do you do that? Strip away Radha and Krishna. Get rid of the deities. Get rid of everything that the British are finding offensive. So, of course, any attempt on the part of the masses weren't so involved in the philosophy. What they wanted was a shot at material prosperity, like the Western nations. So they were looking for political independence, and of course any attempt at that was put down violently by the British. So along comes Gandhi, who says, first let's get rid of the British, then we can get our act together spiritually. Into this moment, when devotion to Krishna was teetering on the brink of total oblivion, appears a young child named Abhay Charan. Abhay Charan's father, Gaur Mohan, is an orthodox Chaitanya Vaishnava, Radha Krishna worshipper, who was determined that his son would not succumb either to the materialistic influence of the West or the impersonalist distortions of the Mayavadis and Indian philosophers, but he would grow up to be a true Radha Krishna Vaishnava. Now, from outward appearances, Abhay Charan was going to lead the comfortable life of a middle-class Gaudiya Vaishnava. Now comes what might arguably be called the call to adventure. In 1922, he meets Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj, who gives him his life mission and says, you're an intelligent young man, go to the West and preach the real message of Krishna consciousness. Now here is a broader vision of a world movement. It's huge. And in young Abhay Charan's mind, he sees that now it is not just India that needs liberating, but the entire world. Compared to this grand vision of his mentor, of his spiritual master, the idea of Gandhi to liberate India from the British pales by comparison. It's small and insignificant. So he quits Gandhi's movement and dedicates himself to the mission of Krishna consciousness. Here at a gathering for the return of disciples from Europe, you'll see Abhay Charan at the far right. That's Srila Prabhupada. In 1935, some early disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati went to Europe, but they had some impact, but it wasn't great. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj had spent huge sums of money to send them there, and he was disappointed. And just days before he passed away, he reiterates his request to Abhay, go to the West. He left this world on January 1st, 1937, now we come to what might be called the road of trials. All this time, Abhay is contending with a family that does not share his enthusiasm for a world mission. He's dealing with a failing business. He tries to get a movement started in India first by founding the League of Devotees, but he loses that property in Lucknow. He wants to persevere in India. I mean, after all, who goes to the West without any money? You die of starvation. But nothing is working. And in dreams, his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami, comes to him and tells him, take the sannyas order, become a renunciant, and go to the West. This is called crossing the threshold. Sannyas in 1959, you see Srila Prabhupada here on the right with his initiating guru, Keshav Maharaj, and one of his godbrothers on the left who also took sannyas that day. Sannyas meant spiritual material social suicide. And Prabhupada described it, the image of becoming a sannyasi for him was horrible. So these are not easy transitions. This is the point I'm trying to make, that nothing good is won easily. Nothing good is won easily. And in the life and mission of Srila Prabhupada, we see, I mean, for me, having researched this book for 3 years, what struck me, people ask, what did you discover? I don't think I was as aware of the depth of his sacrifices, the depth of his poverty after he left his business behind, the depth of the discouragement that he had to deal with on all sides. People were saying, Brijbasis were saying, why are you sticking to this dream? You're here in Vrindavan. Why are you even bothering? He said, no, I've been given this mission. I must go to the West. No one was encouraged. Very few people were offering him encouragement. Now he begins, now that he is a sannyas, the work of preparing to go to the West. But he has nothing. This was his quarters in Radha Damodar Temple in Vrindavan. While he feverishly wrote his books day and night, preparing to go to the West, he thought, at least if I have some books, maybe I can sell some books and I can live off that somehow. So now we come to what is arguably called the ordeal. He convinces Sumati Murarji, the head of Sindhi Steamship Company, to give him passage on a cargo ship, the Jaloduta, and in August 1965, he departs for America, suffers two heart attacks on the way. Now we have what might be called the point of no return, or sometimes the belly of the whale. We reach New York, and there's no turning back. You know, this is it. He's alone, no contacts, nothing. Slowly he attracts students. And now over the course of the next 12 years, we come to what might be called achieving the boon, although in Srila Prabhupada's case, it might be called achieving the book. The disciples discover in a marathon, I think it was 1970, that they could actually do something extraordinary with faith in their spiritual master and the power of his writings. And in the course of 3 days, I believe they distributed something like 18,000 Krishna books. And when Prabhupada heard this, he was stunned. He says, it's unbelievable what's happened. And later he remarked, I see now it was Krishna's miracle. It was possible by faith in his spiritual master's order that if you get some money, print books. He had faith in that order, and now it's working for him. I found this is an old Back to Godhead. It's an illustration of how many books per year. So by 77? How many does, I can't see, 13 million books distributed in 1977. So there's one additional step that's often worked into the monomyth model. It's called resurrection. Resurrection in the case of Srila Prabhupada's hero journey was when the movement was taken to court by, in the mid-70s, there were what was known as deprogrammers. Some of you may recall that irate parents and their cohorts, known as deprogrammers, argued that Krishna consciousness is not a real religion. It's brainwashing. And this, of course, I'm giving you a very, very short summary of all of this. There had been court cases previously, but they had mostly been about lesser issues. For example, the constitutionality of distributing books in an airport. Legal matters like that. For the first time, the theology of Krishna consciousness was on trial. And a lot hinged on this one court case. So Prabhupada instructed Adi Keshava, who was a co-defendant in that trial, go into the courtroom, shaved head, danda, he was sannyasi, robes, tilak, kunti, and all of my books. You bring all of my books, and you argue with them that you have to first read these books. This is legal. If evidence is offered as testimony, it has to be accepted and studied. After several weeks of trial, the New York State Supreme Court declared Krishna consciousness is a bona fide religion with its roots going back thousands of years in India. And this was brought to Prabhupada just a few months before he passed away. And his reaction, I talked to Adi Keshava, I said, what did Prabhupada say? He said, my mission is now accomplished. So there's one other element here, which is the extension of this return to the material world. When Prabhupada went to India, you might call this the return. by bringing disciples back to India, right? That was extraordinary. His dancing white elephants, as people referred to Prabhupada's Western disciples. So there's this unique extension of the return through his disciples. Here you see the New York Times announcement, front page of the dismissal of all charges against Prabhupada's mission. So there's a return through his disciples as well. He may have passed away from this world, but his mission continues. It's not over. It was not the end. It was just the beginning. It's there in the work of the GBC, overseeing the growth of Srila Prabhupada Society. It's there in our late godbrother Bhakti Tirtha Swami, who dedicated his life to the interests of... Shonaka Rishi, who is rectifying through his Oxford Center for Hindu Studies hundreds of years of misimpressions about what is bhakti culture. It was there in the mission of Bhakti Tirtha Swami, dedicated himself to the African and African-American communities. It's there in alternative energy efforts, through efforts and projects such as the Eco Village. We have our first congresswoman now, an initiated disciple, Tulsi Gabbard, who is the co-chair of the Democratic National Committee, if you would pardon me. It's there in the work of late Sadaputta Prabhu and the Bhaktivedanta Institute, who are at the frontier of the confluence of science and consciousness. It's there in spiritual social action in midday meals that is now feeding more than 1 million plates of fresh prasadam to school children in India every day. 1 million hot meals cooked fresh, and each day it's a different meal. It's not the same meal every day. It's there, of course, in the kirtans that are going on, the Sankirtan movement in every town and village of the world. Srila Prabhupada can legitimately lay claim to having spearheaded the kirtan culture as well. The kirtan culture that's become an entire category of music. It's there, of course, in the yoga world, where many of our godbrothers and godsisters are now esteemed yoga instructors, bringing bhakti into the yoga world. My field is international war crimes law, and I can tell you that the warmest receptions in law schools and state bar associations are reserved for moments when I talk about how do you define a human life? If all you think of as human is an oscillating collection of molecular balls and springs, then let the punishment fit the crime and let's all go home. If, however, you allow room for a transcendent dimension to life, something sacred, then maybe we'll move away from a punitive form of justice to a more reformative form of justice. Maybe your opinion toward capital punishment might change. Maybe a lot of things would change if you allow room for a transcendent self. And that same application can be done in every sphere of human activity. Here you see the Mayapur Project. This is a artist rendering of what it will look like. 2022, not too long from now, 6 years away, to the opening of the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the largest religious structure in India and the widest dome in the world. So the example is there in Srila Prabhupada's life, from obscurity to being recognized by, here you see the Dalai Lama putting a garland on a deity of Srila Prabhupada. On the upper right, you see the vice mayor of Paris receiving Srila Prabhupada. Below you see Nelson Mandela and Bhakti Tirtha Swami at the left. So here, by the way, you might ask, well, if it was 13 million books in 1977, where are we now? We're over a half billion books. Another sign, of course, is that we old fogies may be, you know, passing on one by one, but the second and third and fourth generations are just beginning to take the helm of things. So, in a sense, yes. I thought you might like that particular... slide. So, please, however difficult it gets, know this, it's normal. That's normal. Krishna consciousness is not going to be easy. At every moment, we're confronting this call to adventure. And that road of trials is there for every one of us. Our job is to discover what is the unique contribution that I'm supposed to make to Prabhupada's movement. Follow that instinct, follow that intuition, and follow it with all your heart. And I think if we take up that challenge, I believe that future generations will look back at this moment, here and now, And they will say that this was a turning point in the future progress of human civilization. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Yes, Prabhu, please tell me your name and then your comment or question.
Hare Krishna, my name is Krishna Seva.
Hare Bol.
Just look at the news and what's going on around the world. Look at the news and what's going on around the world. We hear so much about ISIS, what's going on in Russia, and if you're watching CNN, so many stories about human slavery, and seem to be so many bad things. And in my mind, I keep on thinking about the golden age of Sankirtan movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I've basically, my question is, what kind of form the golden age of Lord Chaitanya is going to take in this Kali Yuga?
Thank you very much for asking that question. It's a very important question. Srila Prabhupada was somebody for everything. I had the great privilege of traveling with him and not for months and months on end, but for weeks on end. And I had a chance to see our founder Acharya at work. I got a chance to get a direct sense of his mood and his spirit. I can tell you personally that he was someone for everyone and for everything. There isn't anything that he would have turned down. I think if he were here today, he would be looking at, we're in a bad time right now between terrorism and extremism, radicalization, and climate change, and everything else that's going on. I think he would say, what are you doing? Why aren't you out there with solutions to these things? We have the knowledge. Why aren't you applying that knowledge? You know that when it comes to something like terrorism, I won't go into great detail because I do want to have a few more questions here, but you and I can talk about this more later. The greatest inroads toward achieving detente, disarmament, conflict resolution have not been made by the tier one diplomats, the Hillary Clintons and the Condoleezza Rices and the Henry Kissingers of history. They've been made by religious leaders. A religious leader is someone who can work in anonymity because they're not looking to get their name in the newspaper. So they're more trustworthy than political figures. And even if someone is a heinous criminal, he can say to you, I know you don't like me, but I trust you. You're a man of God and you have my interests at heart. So I will tell you something that you can bring to my enemy that I can't even tell my inner circle. Because if I told them that I was willing to negotiate, they'd have my head. We have a role to play in the peace formula in areas of armed conflict. We have a role to play in areas of climate change and environmental destruction. We have a role to play in poverty. We have a role to play in every sphere of human activity. Our job is to figure out what is the language for each of these fields. Each field has its own particular vocabulary. You know, words have changed meaning over the course of time, and our job is to figure out how to present Krishna consciousness in a way that people can appreciate it. So thank you for that question. It's a very important question. Other thoughts, comments? Yes, Prabhu. What's your name, please? Hari Bol.
Thank you for your presentation. Wonderful presentation.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
When we watch a movie, although we're not supposed to, it's anywhere between an hour and a half to 2.5 hours. And we get to see the whole thing, the whole journey that you described today. In real life, it takes years. And we, as aspiring disciples of Srila Prabhupada, if I can say that way, we have a tendency, at least I have a tendency, to only see such a small amount of time in front of me or behind me, and I don't have that broad perspective that you presented to us today. And a lot of times, with that short-sightedness, we have a tendency to be almost part of the problem rather than part of the solution by our verbal contribution. And we see that on social medias. But anyway, long story short, what would be your recommendation to us today so that we, in our daily attitude towards each other, we can imbibe more about this understanding that things will take time?
Okay. Did everyone understand the question? What can we do to overcome apathy? Can I summarize it like that? Okay. Three suggestions for you. First suggestion, take three pieces of paper. Shut off your phone, turn off all the media, take a pen and a clock and sit down at a desk. On the first piece of paper at the top of the page, write 6-month goals and set it aside. At the second page at the top, write 2-year goals and set it aside. At the top of the third page, write down lifetime goals. Now go back to the first page and give yourself 2 minutes and write down everything you can think of that you want to accomplish in the next 6 months. And don't limit yourself. Well, I'd put this down, but I don't have enough money for it, or I'd do that, but I don't know the right people. Put all of those limitations aside. Speak from your heart and put it on paper. No one else has to see it. You can burn it if you want 5 minutes later. But what you want, put it on paper. Do the same thing with the second sheet of paper, what you want to do in 2 years, the next 2 years. Do the same thing with that third piece of paper. What is it that you absolutely have to achieve in this lifetime? Put it down on paper. Look at it. Then go back and spend 1 minute more on each piece of paper and circle the things that are most important. And you start working on those right now. That's my first suggestion to you. The second suggestion is do a population survey. Get to know your community better. Talk it up. I love what my son is doing with these second generation meetings. Get to know the people who are here. There is so much resources. Krishna has given us a treasure right here. And we don't even know what we've got. When was the last time you took the time to introduce yourself to somebody you don't know and just say, tell me about yourself. Where are you from? What's your history? What's your background? I'd like to know more about you. What excites you? You know, what are the things that you want to do in your life? And get to know the community better. And my third recommendation, pray like anything. Just pray. Throw yourself on the floor and pray. Because that's the only way things work. Thank you for your question. Other questions? We have a few more minutes. Yes. What's your name, please?
My name is Franco. So I was reading today.
Hold the mic a little closer.
Reading in the Nectar of Devotion. This quote, I might be misquoting it. It said something like, "These fortunate souls that are experienced swimming in the ocean of the Nectar of Devotion find that that happiness is greater than the happiness derived from." Economic advancement and religiousness, they use the word religiousness, and so I read that, and there's also that verse that Krishna says, abandon all varieties of religion and surrender unto me. So it got me thinking, like, often attachment to religion hinders spiritual development. And I was wondering if that could possibly be the case with ISKCON, if you think maybe people become very much attached to ISKCON such that it hinders their spiritual...
Very good. Very good question. Everyone understand the question? Basically, is religion a help or an obstacle? I'm summarizing. Krishna addresses that in the Bhagavad Gita. He tells Arjuna, I know that people come to me for different reasons. He says, some people come to me for religion. Some people come because they want me to be their god and they want to worship me, you know, because they need money, they're in trouble. So Krishna acknowledges that in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, someone who's coming to me for knowledge, a little better there. When Prabhupada said, my mission is now accomplished, when the New York State Supreme Court ruled that Krishna consciousness is a religion with roots going back thousands of years in India, it was not the success of his mission because the courts called it a religion. You have to understand the distinction. It was because by establishing Krishna consciousness as a valid religious tradition, it differentiated it from all the cults that were springing up in that time, the late 60s and early 70s. It was a crazy time. And that would give him and his disciples and followers a platform with which to explain why it is not a religion. So it was establishing it as a religion in order to deny its religiousness. Okay? It's not a religion. A religion is something changeable. You're Christian today, you become Muslim tomorrow, or Hindu today and Jewish tomorrow. I haven't seen that too often. Anyway. The point being, Krishna consciousness is the eternal nature of the soul, Sanatana Dharma. It's what you are, no matter what you're born into, no matter what your faith may be. It's a law as fundamental to creation as gravity and time and space. Consciousness is substantial. It's inevitable. You cannot avoid the question of consciousness. That's Krishna consciousness. That's the subject of this movement. Not religion. Not ritual. Anything from the other side of the room? Okay, anybody? Yes, I saw a hand here. Eddie Bowl. We have 5 minutes left.
Yeah, my name is Adi Karatadas, Hare Krishna. I was just going to say, I think that a lot of the problems that we had in ISKCON would be avoided in the future because we have a lot more senior people and a lot more experience. And, you know, we may have a lot of trials as individuals, but generally, a lot of the mistakes that were made in the beginning were, you know, due to us being a brand new movement and being Westerners trying to take up a kind of very different culture, although it was very attractive to us. But at the same time, a lot of people weren't really aware of their true identity, so they got into positions that they could have avoided if they had more guidance. So I think for younger devotees, you know, they're in a lot safer position personally because there's a lot more senior people, we have counseling systems, we have experience. ISKCON is on a much more stable platform than it was when Prabhupada left the planet. And, you know, I think we can be hopeful that the younger devotees now won't go through the same trials that we had to go through.
Oh, we can have there's every reason for hope. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Just look around and see what's happened. Things haven't diminished, they've grown. And they're growing by leaps and bounds. This is not the end. This is just the beginning. Just the beginning of something absolutely breathtaking. So thank you. We have time for one more. So I have a question for you. Do you think that presentation stretches things too much by trying to describe things in terms of a hero journey? Does that make Prabhupada's life seem a little too mundane? Is it not necessary? Yeah?
This is Bhaktis too. It seems there's a discussion already going on, and you're bringing them reference points to appreciate and bring Prabhupada into that discussion.
Yeah, okay. Well, if that's the case, then I'm glad. Because the purpose behind this was, how do we make Prabhupada accessible to people? I mean, if all we describe is the Shaktivesha avatar sent by God, you know, to liberate humanity, how do we follow that example? What example is it that we're supposed to follow? It's the example of the sacrifices that he made to get there, showing us that the greatest rewards take the greatest sacrifices. And don't be afraid of those sacrifices. Don't be afraid of those sacrifices. And for every one of us in this room, it's a different story. For some of us, it's having to confront, you know, horrible parenting when we were kids. You know, for somebody else, it's some tragic situation that we had to go through. For someone else, it's never having finished a college degree. I mean, every one of us here has something that we need to look at and do that, whatever it takes, so that you can come up and make your greatest contribution to Prabhupada's mission. That should be done.
My take on this book, Suresha Prabhu, is you are providing a beautiful platform for His divine grace, so He does not stay some abstract figure, but He becomes lively, He becomes available. So please, so far that I am concerned, this is a wonderful effort. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you all very much.